Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court, Michael Murray for the United States. After this $108 billion merger, the nation's largest TV distributor and a TV programmer with critically important content will be able to extract hundreds of millions of dollars more for TV programming because they can threaten to poach the rival's customers if they don't pay up. The district court's contrary conclusion suffers two pervasive logical inconsistencies that I'd like to focus on today. First, the district court concluded that before the merger, bargaining leverage depends on the threat of blackouts, but that after the merger...
Depends on what?
The threat of blackouts.
Oh, yes. All right.
But that after the merger, bargaining leverage depends on whether blackouts will actually happen. Both of those can't be true. Second, the district court also concluded that the new company will maximize its profits when that will help consumers, but won't do so when that will hurt consumers. Again, both can't be true.
You're stating it in a way that creates the inconsistency. To recognize that the principle of maximization across corporate is an incentive is not to say that a particular actor would act in a particular fashion in order to achieve that goal, is it?
I can recognize
the principle without recognizing that it creates the particular incentive for the particular act that you're arguing in this case.
I think that's right, Your Honor. What we're saying here is that applying the logic of Copperweld, which holds that corporations will maximize their overall profits across divisions, means that Time Warner, after the merger, will operate to maximize its
overall. It does not ever mean that a Time Warner actor will necessarily conclude that the corporate profits are enhanced more by blacking out and creating the possibility of a cancellation and transfer of customers than would be the case if they went ahead and didn't black out and got the normal advertising and rights profits.
I think that's
two different things, isn't it?
I think that's right, Your Honor, but no one has...
If that's right, then I don't see the inconsistency.
Your Honor, I don't think anyone has argued here, unless I'm misunderstanding your question, that that Time Warner will not act to maximize its profits. And what we've put forward is that by threatening blackouts, knowing that blackouts are less costly because DirecTV is in the same company, it will obtain more money for the overall corporation. So,
but didn't the district court acknowledge precisely what Judge Santel's question states, that there is this principle? He acknowledged it. There wasn't any dispute about it in that sense. But given what had happened in the market and what was happening in the market, it didn't necessarily follow that the profit path was through blackouts as opposed to maximizing distribution, lower cost, et cetera.
I think that's one way to read the court's opinion, Your Honor.
If that's so, and our standard is clear error, where is the clear error?
The clear error, Your Honor, if we take that interpretation of the opinion, I just want to be clear, that's not how the government's brief understands the opinion. But if we take that interpretation, the only evidence that the court pointed to in the record for that particular proposition was a statement from an NBCU official, an NBCU executive, stating that in their particular company, they don't consider a particular identity. But of course, NBCU and Comcast are under a consent decree from the FCC and the Department of Justice, where the FCC and the Department of Justice agreed, and in fact the defendants urged, the very theory and prediction that is at issue in this case. And so before the FCC, what the defendants told the FCC was that a standard economic model predicts that this proposed transaction would significantly increase the price that other MVPDs pay for NBCU programming.
So what do you do with all the district court's findings about the nature and the change in the market and the evidence about this dramatic change in the last 5 years?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court and certainly the government agrees that the industry is evolving. But I think what the way to think about that point is that there was also testimony in the record, and the district, this is in the district court's opinion, that the defendants consider DirecTV and their MVPD business their golden goose or their cash cow that they're trying to preserve. And so though the industry is certainly changing, the incentives are still the same to preserve, just as they were in the Comcast-NBCU merger, which was a few years ago.
But what I'm trying to explore with you is the incentive to maximize profit may be the same, but is it necessarily by the same path as existed in the previous market condition prior to this 5-year period?
Yes, I understand that, Your Honor. I don't think anyone at trial argued that, or on appeal, has argued that it would be less profitable for Time Warner to ignore DirecTV. What we're saying here, and I think what the evidence showed, was that in rejecting that analysis, Time Warner and the overall company would be leaving money on the table. So they would see hundreds of millions of dollars on the table. They would say, I don't want that, and then turn away.
Yeah,
and that's,
there are hundreds of millions of dollars, whatever you're doing. If you're going on a blackout, you're losing all of the normal advertising subscription profits that you would normally be getting. It's not that they're giving up all profit in order to get what you're saying they should get here with the blackout threat. It is that they could be making a calculus that would go either way.
Right. I think that's right, Your Honor.
The principle of maximization just does not lead to either necessary result. It's a method of analysis. It's not a conclusion.
Certainly, Your Honor.
You have to put assumptions or evidence in order to work an equation.
The government, of course, agrees with I think most of what you said, but what we're saying here is not that the new company will in fact black out. That's what the district court was myopically focused on, but rather that there's a threat of blackouts, and that threat of blackouts will allow Time Warner to increase the prices for its rivals.
Unless the threat is perceived as a possible prediction of reality, then the threat leads to nothing. Yes, the judge could be construed to have said.
But if
you have an empty threat of blackout, you're not going to get a heck of a lot of leverage out of that.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think that that's the proper way to understand the district court's opinion except for its focus, and that would be contrary to the wealth of evidence at trial regarding the threat of blackout. So I'll point, Your Honor, to JA 1713, which lists, and I'll be careful because it's a sealed document, but it lists the blackouts.
Careful about the sealed document.
Yes, Your Honor. It lists the blackouts in this industry. And then I'll point, Your Honors, also to JA 506-07, which is not sealed. And this is testimony from the defendant's own executives stating that they almost went dark, they almost had a blackout, with five major distributors in the preceding 5 or 6 years, with Time Warner Cable over a penny in 2012, with DirecTV, with Dish, with Altice, and with Charter. And so what this shows is that the threat of blackouts is real in this industry. The evidence, the wealth of evidence that the district court didn't focus on because he was focused on whether, incorrectly, blackouts will actually occur, the wealth of evidence showed that blackouts are routinely threatened. In fact, HBO's executive, which is part of Time Warner, threatened Charter with a blackout. The CEO of Turner said that blackouts are always a possibility. The chief negotiator, former chief negotiator, Braylon, testified blackouts are always a possibility. In fact, we prepare drop analyses to see what will happen when there's a blackout. And distributors testified to the same. So there's a wealth of evidence in this case indicating that the threat of blackouts is very real. And what the district court did instead was focus on whether blackouts will actually happen. And that's an inconsistency, an error, because it also concluded that before the merger, Time Warner has bargaining leverage because of the threat of blackouts. So it can't be the case, Your Honor, that before the merger, the leverage comes from the threat of blackouts, but that after the merger, the leverage comes from whether blackouts will actually happen. That's inconsistent.
The case that there's not enough change to create a substantial risk of unfair competition or whatever the language is in the statute there. It can be the case that you can have a threat before and a threat after, and if the threat after is not sufficiently greater to make it a Wagner Act problem, isn't it?
So I don't think that's what the court was concluding, and I'll point, Your Honor, to JA 117 on that front, where the court said the court said that I conclude that the government has failed to clear the first hurdle of showing that the proposed merger is likely to increase Turner's bargaining leverage. And there's some other citations in our brief about where the court concluded that there was no increase in bargaining leverage, not, as my colleagues on the other side have argued, that there was no material increase of bargaining leverage, or I think Your Honor used the term no significant increase in bargaining leverage.
Be better, certainly. However, if the judge did make a finding that there was no increase, that certainly would include the lesser finding that there's no material increase, would it not?
Yes. If he said there's no increase, then no, I think, means no, Your Honor.
Where is the plain error?
The clear error, Your Honor, is that before the merger, he concluded that blackout, the leverage, was based on the threat of blackouts. After the merger, when he concluded there was no increased leverage, he solely focused on whether blackouts would actually happen. And that's just the same type of inconsistency we have in Hines. So in Hines, we have the same type of inconsistency where the court held in part of the opinion, the district court held in part of the opinion, that there was a single market for jarred baby food. And then in assessing the defendant's rebuttal case, it said, well, these two defendants don't compete against each other in this jarred baby food market. And this court said, we can't have that type of inconsistency. That sort of inconsistency can't stand. An opinion divided against itself shouldn't stand. And so it held that was not proper. That's the same type of inconsistency that we have here.
How are we supposed to assess the offer that AT&T Time Warner made with respect to the arbitration, the offer to arbitration and no blackouts? What are we supposed to do with that? What did the district court do with that? Did the district court rely upon that to say that there really wasn't a credible threat of blackouts and that blackouts were infeasible?
I don't think that's what the district court did, so I'll point your honors to JA 196. Where the court's discussion of the arbitration offer is primarily occurring. That's a footnote, a couple paragraphs in the opinion. And there he says that the arbitration offer makes him, more skeptical, or be more skeptical, I think are the exact words, of the government's case. So I don't think that there's a finding on the arbitration offer in the sense that AT&T would like there to be. And that makes sense because this arbitration offer is really too little, too late. And let me spell that out. So the too little is that this arbitration offer is very different from what it was attempting to be modeled on, the arbitration offer for Comcast NBCU.
Let me just say, go ahead.
Well, it's not just in the footnote. That's footnote 51 is what you're talking about on
yes,
page
Your Honor,
149
I think that's right.
of the opinion. There's another part of the opinion, which, of course, because I'm looking for it, I can't find it.
I think you mean JA 152, Your Honor.
Here it is. On page 105 of the opinion, I don't know the JA site because I have the opinion as a separate document that I've been working with.
Sure.
Where it's really pages, 104 and 105, where the district court says that the arbitration proceedings envisioned by Turner's offer are basically similar to what happened with Comcast, NBC Universal. And then he says on page 105 at the end of that first paragraph, given all these similarities, I conclude that Professor Carlton's econometric analysis of the pricing effects et cetera, can be afforded probative weight in predicting the potential pricing effects of the challenge merger. I mean, it seems that the district court relies on those arbitration offers to credit the other side's expert, and the other side's expert is what kills your case. And so isn't there essentially a finding with respect to those contracts that's key to this decision below?
I think the only finding that is in these pages, Your Honor, is that the arbitration offer makes Professor Carlton's analysis of the Comcast-NBC merger sufficiently comparable that it has some probative weight, which I believe is how the district court concluded, put it. But what it is not is a finding, what this is not is a finding that the arbitration offer somehow renders blackouts infeasible. And it makes sense that there is no such finding because the only testimony in the record on the arbitration offer from industry witnesses comes from Charter, Cox, and Dish, all of whom testified that they thought that this was an unproven, risky arbitration offer that did not change the game for them. And
But the district court also said there in footnote 30 at the bottom of page 105 of its opinion that I have confidence that Turner's arbitration offer will have real-world effect. I mean, I don't see how we're supposed to come away from all of this discussion without concluding that the district court essentially made a finding that this arbitration offer was real, tangible, enforceable, would affect the marketplace and the bargaining position of the parties, et cetera, et cetera. But yet, your brief doesn't, you know, make an argument that any such finding was clear error.
Your Honor, I don't think we can read from this one line in a footnote about an unspecified real-world effect that there is some sort of alternative holding of the district court that can be deferred to. This is a pretty slender read to say.
I mean, it's not just there. I've just pointed to other language in the text, not the footnote, and then there's subsequent language along the same lines. I mean, I guess I'm just trying to understand. I mean, on the one hand, you're saying that the district court clearly erred because in a post-merger world, the threat of blackouts, you know, wouldn't change. The efficacy mm-hmm. of that threat wouldn't change. But yet, in the post-merger world, there are these contracts that have been offered for arbitration that weren't there before, and the district court seemed to rely on those contracts. So how can we just ignore that and say the district court has irrationally, you know, switched positions?
Your Honor, so I want to make sure I'm understanding your question. I don't think that the district court said anywhere in the opinion, except perhaps from intuiting from a couple of lines and footnotes, that the arbitration offer somehow changed the game. That's what AT&T wants the opinion to look like on appeal, but that's not what it actually looks like. There's some line in the text, I'll get a paragraph or so, that, as Your Honor pointed out, there's two footnotes on the issue. And there's good reason for that in light of both the testimony that I mentioned that was unrebutted from those distributors, but also in light of the Supreme Court's view on what we should make of these post-acquisition type of maneuvers. As we've discussed in our brief, the courts have looked sort of skeptically on these, and the key case there I'll point you to is General Dynamics, which explained that this type of post-acquisition evidence courts should treat skeptically, and that, in fact, the Supreme Court had twice rejected that type of evidence. And the reason that it rejects that type of evidence, the Supreme Court did, is because it's unproven and it's risky, just like it is in this case. So unlike the Comcast-NBCU merger, where the arbitration offer was based on fair market value, and there was a way to assess that because Comcast was a regional distributor, here DirecTV is a national distributor, so there is no competitive benchmark. Also in Comcast-NBCU, the arbitration offer was backed by the de novo review of the FCC. We don't have that here. We have a private offer among parties. And so that's the reason that the Supreme Court has looked skeptically on this type of evidence, is that it's unproven and risky. And that's exactly what I think the district court's mentions of this mean. To elevate these footnotes and the paragraph Your Honor pointed out into a whole new opinion seems to be exactly the type of concern that the Supreme Court was raising, namely that we're putting too much weight on something that played a bit part in the district court's opinion. I see that my opening time is about to expire.
We're not very good at obeying the clock. Buckwood Robinson said it controls the bar, but only God can control the bench. I have a couple of questions. It may not be of critical importance, but the language in your brief, you assert that the district judge obviously did not understand economic principles. His ruling was consistent with the testimony of the witness, Professor Carlton, was it not?
Some parts were and some parts were not, Your Honor. Professor Carlton testified that corporations maximize their profits overall, so in that sense it was inconsistent.
No, it was not. We've already been over that. We won't go back to that.
We may just disagree, Your Honor.
Corporations don't maximize their profits, did he? The judge? He simply said that that would not work in the way as an incentive that the other expert had posited. He didn't say that principle's no valid, did he?
I think that's one reading of the district court's opinion, Your Honor, and we've been over this, so I don't want to continue to disagree just for the sake of it. But I think you may have another question that you were getting to.
It's related. Did you note the amicus brief of the 37 scholars?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's people like Richard Epstein, Henry Butler, and Christopher Yu, who are all saying that this judge's opinion reflected a deep understanding of economics. Do you still propose, as you said in your brief, that you just didn't understand economic principles?
Your Honor, we stand by what's in our brief, and of course there are the leading antitrust treatise writer is an amici for our side saying that the district court failed to properly apply principles of economics, and I think
it's a different thing than failing to understand principles. The application of it may get down to a difference in Chicago or London, but it isn't the same thing as not understanding to apply it differently than your expert wants him to, or your amicus wants him to.
Your Honor, I think in our brief we use the words misapply and misunderstand almost interchangeably, so I'm not sure that we're actually disagreeing about what we're talking about.
All right. Help me understand this $352 million in savings to customers.
Sure, Your Honor.
The first time the district court refers to that, I think, as savings to DirecTV. And later on, he refers to it more generally as savings to customers. And the argument in part is that just reflects a complete misunderstanding by the district court of what was happening in this area and what Professor Shapiro was trying to point out.
Yes, you're exactly right, Your Honor.
Now I know, but what's the response?
Sure. So the way that the district court used the $350 million was not the type of concession that they talk about, and it couldn't be under this court's decision in Anthem and under the way that Professor Shapiro's model worked. So what Anthem states with respect to efficiencies defenses is that the key is the amount of an efficiency that is passed through to consumers. What the $350 million is, though, is the amount that will possibly be realized to the new company, not the pass-through. The pass-through amount, Your Honor, is $78 million, but that number cannot be derived independently of the amount of raised prices to rivals and the amount of that is passed on to consumers, because in the simulation, both are figured out at the same time. Both are derived at the same time. One can't say Professor Shapiro is wrong about everything except $78 million. The model doesn't work that way. That's not how the math comes out, and it can't be derived.
All right. So then AT&T says, well, even if your bargaining model is accepted on its own terms and the arbitration no blackout mechanism is ignored, the government still failed to satisfy its additional burden of showing that the net retail prices will likely be higher. And then it goes through these 3 points, and you dispute them in your brief, but in terms of a clear error standard of review, how do you prevail in terms of the inflated subscriber loss rate finding, the diversion rates and margins, and then that the district court had improperly relied, ignored the pre-existing contracts?
Your Honor, I don't think we have to prevail in that in the way that Your Honor is outlining, because the government was not under an obligation to quantify the harm in the way that AT&T believes. That's what Brown Shoe.
No, I understand that, but I understand your argument, but what I'm trying to understand is they're saying, as this part of the argument is, assume you're right on your economic theory mm-hmm. and how it works. The problem is, where was the evidence to show that the district court clearly erred in finding that what you did need to show to support the application of the model in this case wasn't there?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the way to think about that is the way that the district court thought about that. So on page 156, and then again on 116 of the JA, not the district court opinion, what the court says is that its rejection is that Professor Shapiro's model is also insufficient to rule for the government. So it's not correct to think of Professor Shapiro's model here on appeal as an alternative ground for affirmance, when what it was in the district court was another reason to rule for the government, and then he rejected that other reason to rule for the government. All that is to say is that the government didn't have to put on the quantification in Professor Shapiro's model. So if we just take the quantification out, the government can still prevail. That's what Brown Shoe stands for when it says that Section 7 is not about exclusively mathematical tests. And that's what Anthem stands for when it says that the loss of...
And, counsel, I'll concede that you're more familiar with this than I am, but my understanding of the issue here was that these are valid economic principles, but it's not enough to just cite the principle. You have to show it fits within the particular context you're dealing with. And that's what, as I understand, this argument is all about. That's before us.
Yes, Your Honor, but Professor Shapiro's quantification had very little to do with the actual fit. So what the fit that they're talking about was established by was the numerous defendant executives who testified, the industry witnesses who testified, and then another part of Professor Shapiro's testimony, not the quantification, but the first half, where he talked about, in sort of a summary fashion, what all this meant, how Nash bargaining worked, and how the incentives would play out. That's separate from his quantification. And so in that part of his testimony, what he explained was that in a situation like this, the incentives change, and DirecTV has a different incentive. All of that, just that part, putting aside the quantification, was enough for the government to prevail.
So even if all the government had was that after the merger, the incentives change, that was enough for the government to meet its burden without putting any numbers in?
No. Yes and no. And let me explain, because that was a double answer there. What the government had to show was that the three key inputs, so to speak, were all not zero. As long as they were all not zero, that's subscriber loss, diversion rate, margin, as long as all of them were not zero, then there's an increase in cost to the rivals. No one at trial testified that any of them were zero. And so even putting aside Professor Shapiro's quantification of exactly how much each number is, the government was able to make its case out, because none of the numbers were zero. And so that means that there was a raised price for rivals, which means that there's an
I don't understand that. I thought that the briefing said that that if you change the number from 9% to 5% in Shapiro's model with respect to, I guess, the number of customers who would I guess, leave if there was a blackout, that completely changed the outcome of the modeling such that there was no longer a price increase. Am I correct about
it's
that?
I think that's right, Your Honor. It's true that the model was sensitive, which is, of course, a virtue of the model, not a bug, as some would have us believe. It's good that the model changes when the numbers change. But I think what that goes to show, I don't think that establishes what I think is the implicit premise of your question, that somehow dooms the government's case, because we didn't have to do any of the quantification to get any numbers out of it. So once we established the testimony from the witnesses about how the incentives would change, and there was no testimony that any of the numbers were zero, there's an increased harm. Then the burden of production goes over to the other side to in the Baker-Hughes framework, to put forward some sort of efficiency defense or some sort of other explanation.
Efficiency. I mean, the saving by however many million it was, the two different versions of it, I guess, but that savings, that evidence is in there. Your own expert put that in.
Yes, Your Honor, but that's only true if you also...
If you use the zero numbers and have a smaller result than that saving, then haven't you lost your carrying of the burden? You have to show that there is... You have to show that there's going to be a harm to competition.
I'm sorry.
You have to show that there's going to be a harm to competition, a substantial one.
Certainly, Your Honor.
And if you have a saving that more than counterbalances the increase in cost that you're talking about, or the increase in the model that you're talking about, then you haven't carried your burden, have you?
Yes, that's also generally true, Your Honor. But you can't just take the $78 million and throw away everything else, because it's all intermingled. It's interdependent in the merger simulation model. You can't derive the $78 million without also crediting Professor Shapiro's testimony on the other
We're
points.
Past that. We're talking about your statement that if the number is anything greater than zero, then you've carried your burden. That doesn't follow. If there is the showing of the $78 million or 300 some million, whichever it is, if there is a showing of that, don't you have to show that there is an increase using the Shapiro, the Nash model that Shapiro was using? Don't you have to show that that number will wind up with a product that is greater than what the saving that's been shown by the other parts of the evidence?
I think that's right, Your Honor, but let me try this a different way so that we're not misunderstanding each other. The district court stated on JA 101 that it was not doing balancing, that what it concluded was that there was no increased costs, full stop, no increased costs at all to rival distributors. That does not make sense if any of the numbers are if all of the numbers are not zero. It's just flatly inconsistent. That can't be the case.
Burdens are.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Remember where the burdens are.
Oh, sure.
You
the government
have carried the burden there in court, in the district court, and then here again, you have to show that there's plain error in the district court. And if the savings number is greater than what results from the Nash analysis conducted by Shapiro, then you haven't carried that burden, have you?
Well, Your Honor, the $78 million is inseparable from the rest of Shapiro. So we can't just say that that's just freestanding on the ledger. And that's not what the district court, in fact, did. He said on JA 101 that he was not doing balancing, that he said that there was no increase. And another way to think about that is that the government didn't make out its prima facie case in this case. And even though, as I pointed out, if those numbers are not zero, all three of those numbers are not zero, and there's no testimony in the record that there was, there is an increased cost to rivals.
So under the government's first theory, though, which is what we've been discussing, the government had to show that the proposed merger is likely to substantially lessen competition by increasing Turner's bargaining leverage in affiliate negotiations. So some of those adverbs, it seems to me, just fly in the face of your statement about if all the numbers are zero, you win.
Under the prima facie case, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I think that what Your Honor said is in some tension with Brown Shoe. So in Brown Shoe, there was no quantification.
No, what I read was simply your first theory.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So you had to put in some evidence somehow beyond just the economic theory.
Yeah.
That the merger would substantially lessen competition, and your first theory was it would increase Turner's bargaining leverage in affiliate negotiations. And the district court heard testimony, made some credibility findings, and explained why he rejected some of the testimony on which you are heavily relying.
Yes, Your Honor, although I don't think he made any adverse credibility findings with respect to the distributor witnesses who testified, and this is Cox, Charter, and Dish, that they were concerned about excessive pricing increases. That's a direct quote from the Charter witness. There's no adverse credibility finding about that issue. There's certainly a lot of findings in the district court opinion on other witnesses, but I don't think there's anything about that. And that's exactly the same type of evidence that the government puts on in prima facie cases all the time, and it's exactly the same type of evidence that entirely carried the day in cases like Brown Shoe. where there was no quantification, there was none of this regression simulation modeling that the government put on. It would be sort of perverse to say that the government is worse off for putting on a quantification and attempting to provide a readout.
I don't think anybody's saying you're worse off for putting on the quantification. I think we are saying that if you're going to rely on an economic model, you have to rely on it with quantification. The bare theorem of John Nash's theorem doesn't prove anything in a particular case. You have to have numbers to make a model work. That's what a model is.
Your Honor, I don't think that's consistent with antitrust precedents like Brown Shoe or Anthem.
What in Brown Shoe is that inconsistent with?
There was no quantification in Brown Shoe. What they did was they put on testimony explaining the harms from the vertical merger. They didn't attempt to quantify those in any respect. Now, the harms in Brown Shoe or in Anthem, where this court accredited the idea that the loss of Cigna's high-touch medical practice was itself anti-competitive, none of that involved a quantification. So I don't think it's – I think Your Honor is drawing a distinction that the government respectfully disagrees
with. Brown Shoe using modeling?
No, Your Honor, but
– It's not using modeling. So whether or not – whatever Brown Shoe said, it has nothing to do with whether you have to use numbers in order to make modeling relevant into a real-world case.
Your Honor, I disagree with I respectfully with the premise of that question, which is that the testimony about how Nash bargaining works is not modeling in the same sense I think that Your Honor is using it to refer to quantification. That's just a way to explain the witness testimony. That's exactly what they had in Brown Shoe. You might think of it as like an opening or closing argument, sets up how the witnesses will be framed. That's what Professor Shapiro did here with respect to Nash bargaining. He took the words of the distributors and he helped the district court understand that. That was not a quantification. That's the first half of Professor Shapiro's testimony, and that type of expert testimony is present, of course, in antitrust cases across the country. That's not a quantification, and it's not a modeling in the same in the sense that you're using, which I think is synonymous with.
If you're going to get the findings you want in the end, you have to have some numbers. It's not enough to say this is a valid theory that has been used in other antitrust cases. You have to have some numbers to show that you have the effect on competition that you have to prove to carry your case.
There were no numbers in.
See how you can credibly argue that you can simply present an economic principle, whether we're talking about modeling or some other way of presenting it, and say that's the principle, therefore we win.
But that's not what I'm arguing, Your Honor. So let me try it again, because I think maybe we're misunderstanding each other. What we're saying here is that the government can put on evidence from industry witnesses, from the defendants themselves, from the defendants' own filings before the FCC to show what will happen after the merger.
So the probability of what will happen after the merger. So Professor Shapiro's model, according to his testimony, was designed to identify the incentives that would exist after the merger. So that's not putting a precise number, but your position is that is sufficient for the government to meet its initial burden of proof?
Yes, I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. So one way to think about it is that Professor Shapiro actually has two separate lines of testimony, and the district court's opinions organization actually reflects this. The first half of his testimony is about what he thinks there's a reasonable probability of happening after the merger. And what he does is he looks at the industry testimony, he looks at the defendant's testimony, the defendant's filings, and he says, here's how I would analyze this as an expert witness. And then there's another part of Professor Shapiro's testimony that has to do with quantification. And what we're saying is we don't need that quantification part. We may or may not need the bargaining theory. It depends exactly how the witnesses, the bargaining theory testimony, depends how the witnesses came in, whether they were understandable, et cetera. But it certainly helps to have that type of expert testimony to help the judge make sense of it.
So then to the extent that Professor Shapiro acknowledged that there were some, I'll use the word defects, in his analysis, what's your response?
So I don't know
I'm
if
not
I'm
not in the quantification part. I'm in the bargaining theory part.
I'm not sure what exact defects you're referring to, Your Honor. I think Professor Shapiro thought that his explanation of
taken into account the long-term contracts, for example. He said he hadn't examined some of the underlying data, that type of thing.
Right. So, for example, with the long-term contracts, I think it's clear from antitrust principles and the Supreme Court's case law in Cargill and El Paso that's not the type of reason to put aside particular testimony, because what we're concerned about is the arresting anti-competitive tendencies in their incipiency.
I know, but just help me out here. If they're long-term contracts, doesn't that affect the incentives? In other words, my incentives may be different if I'm not faced with obligations under long-term contracts. That's what I'm trying to focus on. That type of defect could affect the incentives after merger. That's all I'm trying to understand the government's position on.
I think that's right if they're permanent contracts, but if they're occasionally renewed or renegotiated, then the incentives will just wait 1 year to be realized. I think that's right in response to Your Honor's question. But I think what the Professor Shapiro's ultimate analysis on the long-term contracts was exactly spot on in light of the court's decisions in El Paso Natural Gas, where there was a long-term contract and the Supreme Court wasn't concerned, and also in Cargill, where there was a potential short-term drop in prices contemplated with a potential long-term increase in prices, and the Supreme Court, again, was not concerned about that discrepancy. And so I think that's both appropriate and accurate for Professor Shapiro to consider. I see that my time has
opened. I do have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So I'm not sure that I understand what your position is with respect to the $350 million savings efficiency number. So it appears that whatever that number is, it isn't a number that anyone said would be actually passed on to consumers, at least not the witnesses said that. But that is what the district court said, at least twice in its opinion. Mm-hmm. That seems somewhat troubling, and I'll have questions for the other side about that. But the amicus brief of the Open Markets Institute, I think it is, says that, you know, once the plaintiffs establish that there's a reasonable probability of a substantial reduction in competition from the merger, that's it. That there is no efficiency defense, so to speak. And so all of this discussion about efficiencies, I mean, they don't lay all of this out, but I guess what they seem to be saying is that's it's really beside the point. Doesn't seem to be the way that you're arguing this or that you argued this in your brief. Am I wrong about that, or help me understand what your position is?
No, I think you're right about that. We've taken the position following the Anthem decision that if there is an efficiencies defense, then it has to be focused on the pass-through number. And so here, in some sense, the court doesn't have to focus on how to resolve the question that was discussed in Anthem, because the district court, as Your Honor pointed out, had the wrong number. AT&T tries to just sub in the new number, and it really can't do that. And it's not just two times, Your Honor. I think it's four or five times that the $350 million or $352 million comes up in the opinion. So that is the way that we've addressed it. It's whatever the efficiencies defense is, however that works, and we realize there's dispute among circuits and perhaps within the circuits on that point. It can't be what AT&T has suggested, which is that we just say $350 million, which is not the pass-through number, and then we call it quits. That can't be the case. And so,
if we agree with you on that, is that sufficient to remand? So, even if we disagree with you about everything else?
So I don't know if that is, Your Honor, to be honest. Obviously, I'd like to answer that question, yes, but I think the best way to understand the district court's opinion is to conclude that it didn't actually do balancing, that it just said that there's no price increase to the rival distributors, and so it didn't even really do the type of balancing that I think my colleagues on the other side would have you believe, such that there's a balance in the ledger of $350 or $78 million. I don't think that's what the court did, and I'd point Your Honor to JA-101 on that point, where it says that it's not doing the type of balancing, just no price increases is its conclusion. And so I think that answers Your Honor's question.
All right. Thank you.
I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you. Yes, thank you. All right, counsel. Let me guess for the 27 antitrust scholars.
As opposed to the 37 scholars.
Yes, right.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Eric Citron. I'm appearing here for the 27 law professor Amiki, who filed in support of neither party. I just wanted to thank the court for giving us some time to share our perspective, maybe say a word about what we're doing here. The reason that my clients wanted to participate in this case is that there are two points that are made in a really important part of the district court's opinion. It's the part where he's rejecting the application of the Nash bargaining model, or saying essentially that he doesn't think it fits in this case. And both of the reasons that he gives there, we think represents some pretty serious confusion about important points in antitrust law. One of the points is essentially legal. It has to do with how Copperwell ought to be applied and understood. The other point is essentially economic. It has to do with how the Nash bargaining model works. And I'm going to start with the second one because I think that's where the greatest opportunity for confusion is. If you look at the district court's opinion, it's pretty clear he thinks that he has a special case on his hands, because even after the merger, Time Warner is going to have an incentive to make a deal, that it's going to be way better off, more profitable, if it does deal instead of going into a long-term blackout. And here's the really important point. That's not a special case for Nash bargaining. That's the ordinary case for Nash bargaining. The whole point of the Nash theorem, the whole problem John Nash is trying to solve, is what happens when both sides are better off from making a deal? How do they divide up the spoils, the surplus that making a deal creates?
So let me ask you, on JA-131, where the district court says that the use of the Nash bargaining model in this context of affiliate fee negotiations counts as a mark against defendants' attempts to disavow the applicability of the theory in this case. And there's a parenthetical saying it's a weak, faint one. But he says, rather, my conclusion in this case doesn't turn on the defendants' protestations that the theory is preposterous, et cetera. It says, it's on my evaluation of the shortcomings in the proffered third-party competitor testimony, the testimony about the complex nature of these negotiations and the low likelihood of long-term Turner blackout and the real-world pricing data and experiences. Are you saying one or more of those points is wrong?
Yep.
As a matter of what, economic principle?
Yeah, matter of economic theory, for sure. And thank you for drawing my attention, because I wasn't going to mention this part of this passage, but it's an important one. The testimony about the complex nature of these negotiations and the low likelihood of a long-term blackout.
Right.
Okay. The Nash bargaining model predicts that blackouts would be infrequent and probably never occur, because both sides are better off making a deal. That's not a special fact about this case. It is an ordinary fact. It is what we expect to find when both sides are better off making a deal. And so, and this is part of the reason.
But what about the language that's cited in, I think, the 37 scholars' amicus brief from, I guess it's the 1953 Nash article, where Nash seems to endorse that or suggest that the threat's got to be realistic?
The threat has to be credible, but and I'm very happy to talk about why the threat should be understood as credible in this case. I just want to point out that the likelihood that the parties will actually go to war or go into a labor strike or have some catastrophic outcome isn't an input into the model, even when you're worried about the credibility of the threat. It's just an output. We're trying to figure out what's going to happen, how they're going to divide up the surplus. We expect them to make a deal. Low probability of having a blackout is the expected outcome, not the extraordinary one. The reason I think you have to understand the threat as credible in this case is that we know before the merger that Turner was not giving away its content for free. It had at least enough bargaining leverage that there was a price at which it was willing to walk away. And this is sort of a misunderstanding the district court has. Credibility, when you're talking about prices, agreed prices, it's not like an on-off switch, right? It's credible at a particular price. You know, if you had said, Turner, you pay me to display your content so you'll get advertising dollars, you know, Turner White say, no, I'm not going to do that. And that means that at some price point, it's credible, right? And what happens here, the 100-pound weight to the 950-pound weight footnote, right? The intuition there is that they're both fatal. We know the first one's not fatal. There's some price at which Turner will walk away. And that price is demonstrably changing when the alternative to making a deal gets better for Turner. And that's what happens, right? That's what Professor Shapiro's testimony is. After the merger, if Turner doesn't make a deal, that will get better. That outcome is better for Turner, not better than making a deal. Making a deal is always better. But the downside risk goes down a little bit. That means that the price at which they're willing to make a deal goes up, and the prices that we expect them to impose on their counterparties in negotiations goes up too. And so this thing that blackouts are unlikely, that Turner is still going to be interested in making a deal afterwards. You know, I think some real aspects of confusion, you can see them on pages 116 and 117 of the opinion, JA 163 and 164. You know, when he says, and Professor Shapiro acknowledged that a long-term blackout of Turner content, even post-merger, would cause Turner to lose more than the merged entity would gain. That's, again, what we expect. That's if that wasn't true, this would be a really trivial case. It would just mean that Turner didn't have an interest in making a deal and never would, right? The hard problem is when both sides do have an interest in making a deal and we're trying to figure out how they divide it up. So that's the first point. The second point.
So can I just go to 163, JA 163?
Yeah. So when the judge seems to think that it's notable that Professor Shapiro acknowledged that a long-term blackout of Turner content, even after the merger, would cause Turner to lose more in affiliate fee and advertising revenues than the merged entity would gain, right? Again, that it would hurt Turner more not to agree is not a special fact or a notable fact about this case. It's the ordinary fact. That's what makes this a Nash bargaining case at all. If that wasn't true, Turner's view would be, I'm not making a deal. I'm better off with no deals. And we'd have a totally different kind of case on our hand. It wouldn't involve Nash bargaining.
But so, if there is in the case discussion of the maximization across the corporate structure of profits, just not what the judge wrote there germane to the understanding of that principle or the applicability of that principle?
I'm not sure that I understand exactly what you're asking. And I just want to make sure that I'm responsive.
He's saying that the judge's language concerning the relative profit loss of the blackout or not having the blackout is not germane to the decision that should have been made by the judge in this case. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, that's right.
However, in the evidence presented by the government in this case, there was discussion of the principle of maximizing profits across the corporate structure.
Mm-hmm.
Was not what the judge had to write here, what the judge wrote here, germane to the discussion of that subject?
I think he is saying something about the maximization of profits across, yep. But I think that point is also very problematic, and that's the other one that our my clients wanted to participate in the case to point out. The way that Copperweld works, right, is that after the merger happens, it's impossible for AT&T and Time Warner to coordinate their conduct in any way that would violate the antitrust laws. They're a merged entity. That's what Copperweld says. They have only a unitary interest. That means that we have to assume that after the merger, they're going to find some way to maximize profits for the parent company. Because if they do, there's nothing the antitrust laws can say about it anymore. This is our only opportunity to intervene. And that's why it's really important that we have a rule that says when two parties merge, we assume that they are going to do the thing that maximizes the parent's profits. And that is another point.
Different question than determining what the thing is that maximizes profits.
Oh, for sure.
We're back to the same problem we had with the government. It's not enough to state the principle. You have to show how that principle affects the burden under the antitrust law.
I think that's right, although, I mean, I completely agree. The underlying principle is that they will maximize profits however that is done.
Which but, may or may not involve bargaining to blackout, bargaining to impasse.
And again, remember, the Nash marketing model predicts that it doesn't involve imposing a blackout.
Yeah.
Right? It's just threatening a blackout.
Back to my original question, the judge's language was germane in terms of how the government presented its case, since the government brought in the principle of maximizing profits across the corporate structure, was it not?
I mean, I think that his language is not germane to the correct question that he needs to be asking, which is what happens if Time Warner and AT&T figure out the position that is profit maximizing for the parent company after the merger? And the position that is profit maximizing for the parent company after the merger is to only accept a slightly higher price, or at least a somewhat higher price, than it accepts right now. You cannot assume, the district court seems willing to indulge the possibility that because it's complicated or something like that, they're just going to direct Time Warner to continue maximizing Time Warner's revenue and DirecTV to maximizing DirecTV's revenue, and Time Warner won't even be willing to threaten things that might divert some profits to DirecTV. And so, we shouldn't indulge that assumption.
So do you have the record in front of you, JA?
I have only the district court's opinion in front of me.
Page 117,
uh-huh.
District court's opinion, that last paragraph.
Yeah.
In view of the evidence, you would say all of that illustrates the misunderstanding?
Yes, unfortunately, yes. In view of the evidence on the prospects of a long-term blackout, right? Again, the prospects of the long-term blackout are not actually an input into the model. We need to be worried about the district court's opinion precisely because he's quite focused on whether or not blackouts are likely or not, right? And in Nash bargaining, again, the prediction of the Nash model is that the parties will agree, typically on the first day. They just, like the district court says but seems to misunderstand, they threaten blackouts, one against the other and the other against the one, until they reach some division of the joint benefits of their deal.
So what's the difference between what you're telling us and what I understood your brief to be urging us to conclude, is that vertical mergers per se are fine as far as the antitrust laws are concerned?
Well, I first of all hope there's no difference between what I'm saying now and what's in the brief.
No, this is just to help me understand.
Okay.
And I thought that was the thrust of Judge Santel's questions to you as well. The rule isn't that vertical mergers implicate no antitrust concerns under the antitrust laws.
Do you
agree with that?
They certainly do implicate concerns under the antitrust laws.
So a district court faced with this situation has to deal with some of these circumstances, doesn't it?
Well, it depends what you mean by these circumstances.
Well, I cited you to the last
time. So in this paragraph, what's wrong with this paragraph?
Yeah.
What he should be concerned about is not the prospects of a long-term blackout, but what would happen to either party after the merger if a blackout occurred, right? It doesn't matter how likely that is to happen. The model actually predicts that it's very unlikely to happen. But the way that bargaining parties divide up the spoils of agreement has to do with how valuable it is to the one and the other to reach that agreement. Right? He needs to be concerned, I think this language is helpful, he needs to be concerned with the stakes of a blackout or the stakes of failing to agree, not the odds of failing to agree. The odds don't go into the model. They come out of the model. They're an output. They're something that the model predicts. In order to apply the model correctly, you need to be focused on finding the stakes for the two parties. And what Professor Shapiro is testifying to, and this makes economic sense, it does fit, is the stakes of a blackout for Turner will go down after the merger because some of its lost subscribers, because some of the counterparty's lost subscribers will be redirected to Turner's corporate parent, AT&T.
So how does the Nash model work in a NBC Universal Comcast world with the arbitration, no blackout provisions?
I mean, I think it works the same way. What we need to figure out is what the consequence is of the arbitration offer. What we need to do is assume that the parties don't agree, and instead of not agreeing, I'm not sure what happens. Go into arbitration, sometimes go into arbitration, might not go into arbitration. I don't think we have a position on exactly how the arbitration offer would fit if it was bona fide.
I'm not asking about the arbitration offer in this case. I'm saying in a known case, a merger that has happened and was approved with that stipulation, the NBC Universal Comcast merger.
Right. So because
does Nash bargaining is it still relevant if we were to examine that?
It's absolutely relevant. It is substantially more complicated. So once you assume that there's the ironclad arbitration rule, right, then the alternative to making a deal isn't a blackout anymore. It's an arbitration, and we'd be trying to predict what the possible outcomes of the arbitration are. I think that prediction is economically critical. It is obviously not what the district court is doing in this case. There's no discussion of anything like this. And so it doesn't erase any concern or make the model inapplicable. It just changes what the walkaway situation is when the parties don't agree. So you would want to see some analysis of it. I just want to make one other point about the arbitration offer, and it relates to the Copperweld point I was making. If before we accept post-merger, post-complaint conduct as a bomb to a merger that we're worried about, we need to be really sure that this offer that AT&T is making is ironclad. It's not going to change. It couldn't be revoked or altered. Because if it is revoked or altered, it's not like NBCU Comcast, where it's a condition of the merger. This merger cannot be unwound, right? So if that arbitration term is essential to our theory of why this can't hurt consumers, we need at least a finding from the district court that this offer is ironclad as a matter of law and is definitely going to have some effect.
Well, he makes a finding. I know the government doesn't agree. I don't think that he's confident. The district court says he's confident that AT&T isn't going to walk away from this.
Yeah, I don't think we know enough about, that is to say my clients and I know enough about about the arbitration offer to say any more than that it's very important that we be certain that it is ironclad.
Fine.
That there's an argument that it may not even be irrevocable under Georgia law. None of that is in the district court opinion. That's worrisome. That's all I really want to make sure I communicate about it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, we'll hear from counsel for appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'd like to address, in the course of my time here, Judge Wilkins, your questions about arbitration and the $352 million in consumer savings. Judge Rogers, your questions about the role of the discussion of inputs in the model. And Judge Santel, your questions about the roles of the model and quantification, because I think actually those questions individually and in combination really cut through so much of what the counsel for the government and the amici have said today. Because the decision below turned on a series of very specific and independent factual findings, and the government and the amici have largely ignored those findings that established that the government didn't meet its burden of showing that this particular merger would likely cause a retail price increase for video subscribers. And let me start with the arbitration issue, Judge Wilkins, that you raised, because everything that Mr. Citron said before the last 2 minutes and everything that Mr. Murray said is all premised on the idea that these companies can wield a credible threat of a permanent blackout, that they will walk away from a distributor. And in fact, the government says on page 43 of its brief that if Turner truly couldn't walk away, there would be no leverage. Well, Turner truly can't walk away now because of the arbitration no blackout commitment. That is a commitment which is legally enforceable and which says that any distributor at the point of an impasse can invoke it, and then we have to continue to provide their signal. There's no temporary blackout. There's no permanent
blackout.
Where is
the finding on the district court to that effect?
Well, what the district court said, Your Honor, in the footnote that Your Honor pointed to and in the earlier portion in the text, he called this extra icing on the cake already frosted, by which he meant, I think, that this was an additional reason. And he made several findings in those portions. First, he said that distributors would invoke it. Second, he said we would honor it. And third, he said it would have real-world impact and affect these negotiations. And it only can affect the negotiations in one way, which is by taking the blackout off the table. And, you know, Mr. Citron said a moment ago, it doesn't make the Nash model inapplicable to have the arbitration blackout. It makes Professor Shapiro's litigation model absolutely inapplicable. And Professor Shapiro said that. He said it would require an entirely different model in order to capture and reflect the arbitration commitment.
So the arbitration commitment wasn't a commitment for every contract going forward forever, was it? It was just for this next, the next set of...
For the next 7 years. And we chose 7 years, Your Honor, because it mirrored the period of time that the government found sufficient to address all competitive concerns in the Comcast-NBCU proceeding in 2011. And look, we had thought that if that was sufficient for the government then, in the last administration, it would be sufficient now. It wasn't, and so we made the commitment anyway and took it to the court. And the government's response here is very, very telling because it really had no response. Professor Shapiro said it would take a completely different model than mine to capture the real world that will actually be in effect because of this arbitration commitment in which you can't black out. And we asked him, well, then how can you justify going forward with your model? And he said there's another government witness, an expert witness, Professor Cuoca. He will explain. And then the government never called Professor Cuoca. So on this record, there literally is no response. And these are findings, Your Honor. We will honor it. The other side will invoke it. It will have real-world effect, and it takes everything that people have said about the threat of a blackout off the table. What it means is that not only doesn't Turner have more leverage as a result of the merger, Turner has less leverage as a result of the merger. Turner has relinquished the source of leverage that the government identified in its view as the principal way to extract higher prices. So that is one thing that by itself ought to be sufficient to resolve the case. But then to go on, Judge Rogers, to your questions about the inputs, because there are all sorts of problems with Professor Shapiro's model. I mean, to begin with, there is the point, Judge Wilkins, that you made that when you said it kills the case. The district court found, based on the trial evidence, that no prior vertical transactions in this industry showed the price increase that the Professor Shapiro's government model predicts, meaning it was wrong with respect to every transaction that existed in the real world that you run against it. We put forward that analysis, and it's important to know what the government did in response. The government did not put any contrary empirical analysis there. It did not do what Professor Shapiro said in a prior merger proceeding you should do when you try to apply bargaining theory to a merger, which is test it against real-world transactions and see whether the model actually gets the answer right. It got the answer right none of the times. The district court credited that testimony. The government didn't even challenge it as erroneous, much less clearly erroneous, in the opening brief. So as this case comes to the court, it is established that the model does not correctly predict price effects from mergers in this industry, and that's before you even get to the fact that it leaves out the fact that going forward you will have no blackout threat at all, but instead this arbitration remedy. And so then, Judge Rogers, the question is, well, what about the inputs? Well, the district court could have stopped right where I just said, but he didn't. He went on and said, even though we have not been shown that the model is a valid predictor of prices, I am going to see what happens when you actually run the model. He accepted the model and scrutinized the inputs that the government had plugged into it. And critically, when the court accepted the model, it was accepting all of the government's economic presuppositions about bargaining leverage and the economics of bargaining and profit maximization and all of those things. It was also accepting the government's view of the extent of consumer benefits, the $78 million. And, Your Honor, it is correct that there are places in the opinion. The government predicted that there would be $352 million in cost savings to AT&T, which would result in $78 million of cost savings to customers. And there are places in the opinion where the district court mischaracterized the government's prediction as being $352 million rather than $78 million of savings to the retail customers. But that makes absolutely no difference to the outcome of the case, as I think Mr. Murray acknowledged when he said that error alone couldn't be a candidate for reversal, because when the court went on to apply the model, it was applying Professor Shapiro's view of the $78 million of consumer benefits. And what the trial showed about that model was its extreme fragility and its extreme sensitivity to even modest changes in the inputs. And with respect to Mr. Murray, that is a bug. It is not a feature, because at the end of the day, when you apply all of the government's economic assumptions and every one of its preferred inputs, it still predicts only a 0.2% price increase, which the district court found had not been subjected to any statistical testing, had not been shown to be statistically significant, was statistically indistinguishable.
That's an amount for each consumer. You know, let's say it's a 25 cents a quarter, but that's per month.
Yes, on a cable, yes.
And there's, you know, upwards of 100 million or so consumers that are paying that, right?
That's right, Your Honor. We do think that the percentage is a fair way to characterize it, in the same way that, you know, a $2 increase in the price of gas is significant and a $2 increase in the price of a car is not, even if you multiply that $2 increase by, you know, all of the car transactions in a year. But the key thing we think is this: whether you think about it in the absolute number or the percentage number, the key thing is how sensitive it is to minor corrections in the inputs. And this will be true whether you use the percentage or the absolute number, because just minor corrections completely flips the result from predicting a retail price increase of 0.2% to a retail price decrease, often of much higher magnitude. And when the result is so tiny, has not been shown to be statistically significant, and flips once you correct what are really obvious errors in the reliability. And Judge Rogers, I'd like to address just a couple of those inputs, because they alone provide grounds for affirming this case because of the stark unreliability of the inputs that the government used. So the first key input was the subscriber loss rate that Mr. Murray referred to, and that's the estimate of how many customers would leave a distributor if Turner wasn't there and go somewhere else. And Professor Shapiro said he was estimating a range of 9% to 14%, and 9% was the figure he plugged into his model. He acknowledged, as you said, Judge Wilkins, that if you changed that 9% to 5%, just made that one change, the entire predicted price increase goes away and it becomes a predicted price decrease. So where did that 9% come from? Well, first of all, it's completely out of whack with every known permanent blackout that's occurred in this industry, which are recited in the opinion, which were 2% and 2.5%. The 9% came from a consulting report that the firm Altman Velandry produced for its cable client, Charter. And on pages JA 170 through 174, the court goes through methodological failing after methodological failing of that report, and the government challenges none of those findings as erroneous, much less clearly so. But then there was even the bigger problem, which is where that 9% number came from. The reason we talked about changing 9% to 5% is that 5% was the number in the Altman-Velandry report that was presented as the, quote, final report to Charter. It was changed later via an email that was sent by the Altman-Velandry project manager from the boarding line at the airport with no additional empirical work, nearly doubled. And Professor Shapiro, when he was confronted with this at his deposition, had no idea that that was the provenance of the number. That alone makes it unreliable. It was the government's burden to show below that it was reliable. It's the government's burden here to show that it was clearly erroneous for the district court to find it unreliable. Neither of those showings could be made given the complete ignorance of the government's expert about how that number was actually created. And if you change that number to the original 5%, the price increase goes away. And then you get to the second input where something very similar happened, because there was this key cord-cutting number of 10% that Professor Shapiro used. Where did that come from? It came from the same Altman-Velandry report, and the trial evidence revealed that their original empirical number had been slashed by 40%. And nobody, including Professor Shapiro, could explain why. Professor Shapiro said he didn't even know if he knew about that when he decided to adopt the number. And we made that a centerpiece of that section of our brief. The government, in its reply brief, doesn't even try to defend or explain why the number was slashed 40%. But again, if you just take that input, keep everything else constant, and make that one change, the price increase that the government's model predicts flips into a price decrease. And
so, as I hear your argument then, it's, first of all, whatever virtues the model may have, and Professor Shapiro's opinion, all of that disappears with the addition of the arbitration clause. And Judge Wilkins was exploring earlier how solid that is. And all we have is that footnote finding by the district court that he's confident that AT&T will not walk away. Do you view that as a finding, that it's permanent for 7 years, that there's no uncertainty under state law?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And let me specifically address, in the reply brief, the government makes one argument with respect to state law. It says that under Georgia law, an offer without consideration is not enforceable. So let me just be very specific here. First of all, most of these contracts are under New York law, not Georgia law, and that principle isn't there. Even under Georgia law, once the commitment is accepted, it is enforceable. So what they're suggesting is that in whatever interval of time between the time we make the offer and before the other side accepts, under Georgia law, we might have a claim that it's not enforceable. But that's the gap that Judge Leon has filled in his opinion when he finds, and I do think it is a finding, that we will honor it. And of course we will honor it. We're now judicially estopped from not honoring it. We've gone to a district court, and I'm going to this court saying we're going to honor it. He relied on it in part. Your honors are welcome to rely on it. And we are absolutely judicially estopped because, of course, we don't make an offer like this in the marketplace and intend to say, you know, we had our fingers crossed behind our back when we made it go away. That's not going to happen.
Well, we take you at your word.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
You know, but
no, but I mean, it's serious.
No,
because that means that the district court's approval of the proposed merger was contingent on the arbitration clause being a condition of the merger.
Yes. I mean, the only thing I would say, it was one of several independent grounds.
No, I understand, but
absolutely, Your Honor. So we are absolutely committed to this.
I don't understand you to say that the government must prevail both on the economic theory proposition as well as what we're calling the quantification theory, that the bargaining theory model can work, but it simply didn't work here based on the evidence. Your argument
is that
the government presented, particularly in view of the arbitration clause.
That's exactly the point, Your Honor. And it really goes to this distinction that Judge Santel was drawing earlier between the Nash bargaining theory writ large and what that tells you and the litigation model that the government constructed here. Because the Nash bargaining theory doesn't tell you what's going to happen to this merger. The government had to construct a litigation model with various assumptions and inputs and others to demonstrate that even though it conceded that there would be benefits, that the harms would outweigh the benefits. And that's why some measure of quantification was necessary, because once you concede there are benefits, you have to make some showing in some fashion that the harms will be greater, and that's what the model was designed to do. And so just to take a step back here in terms of what really happened at this trial, the government came forward with this model as its effort to meet its burden of proof to show that the harms outweigh its conceded benefits. At the outset, we showed that it didn't, in fact, it wasn't a good model. It didn't correctly predict prices from real mergers, from any of them that had happened in the industry. The government presented no contrary analysis, and that was a really big problem. And then the court looked further and found that the model was just not taking into account big major influences on the outcomes of these negotiations and pricing, things like the arbitration clause, which completely changed the game. And then he nonetheless went on further, and he said, okay, let's assume the model is a good predictor. Let's assume it takes into account every relevant factor, and let's see what it actually predicts as to retail prices. And that's where we got into the input discussion and the fact that one input was emailed from an airport boarding line, and the expert
didn't. But let me go back to that.
Okay.
I mean, the provenance of this Altman-Valandry study, as best as I can tell from the district court, I'm looking at page 122 of its opinion. I don't know what the JA site is. Was that this was created by this consulting firm for Charter, and the court says to help them predict their subscriber losses in the event of permanent blackouts with various programming networks. So this was to be a document that Charter would use to help it analyze, I guess, its bargaining position vis-a-vis programming networks, right?
Yes.
So why in the world would the consultant give Charter bad information or overestimate the subscriber losses so that Charter would feel like that it was in a weaker position than it really actually is in? I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
I want to be careful about how I answer that question, Your Honor, because I want to acknowledge that there's no definitive finding in the district court in answer to that question. But certainly, in terms of the facts that were made known, this is a report that shortly after the change was made was supplied to the Department of Justice by Charter, and Charter is an opponent of this merger. And the change that was made from the airport boarding line, this was a report that covered every programmer. The change that was made from the airport boarding line by email, 5% to 9%, was made by the Altman-Volandry project manager after a meeting with Charter, but with no additional empirical work. But for our purposes, while we have our concerns and suspicions about what lay behind it, you know, the district court didn't resolve that. He says it gives him pause, he said, but he did not resolve that, and I don't want to suggest that this court should base a conclusion on our suspicions. It is sufficient that a number created that way is completely unreliable, and certainly unreliable when the government's expert says he did not know that's how it was developed when he relied on it. And that and the slashing the 40% that he didn't know, that was the reason for the district court's observation that the government's expert seemed unfamiliar with the provenance of the materials and the data that he was dealing with. And so here we are at a stage where the question is simply, was it clearly erroneous for the district court to find unreliable a number that was changed in this fashion, whatever the reason, let's even assume it was good faith, but was changed in this fashion, and the expert didn't even know that that's where it came from. And that's just the one aspect of it we focused on. You know, it also was completely out of whack from the 2% and the 2.5% and the other actual record evidence of real-world experience with permanent blackouts. And, you know, the government doesn't really contest any of what I've just said in their brief. They make just one argument about this number. And their one argument is it doesn't really matter, they say, whether the 9% was a good number or a bad number. The point is that all that really matters is what Charter subjectively believed. Now, that's not a theory they raised before this appeal, but there are two problems with it in any event. One is there is no evidence below about what Charter believed. The government called one witness from Charter. He was asked whether he could testify that he believed this number to be accurate or reasonable, and he said he just wasn't familiar with it enough to say that. So there is no evidence in this record about what Charter believed. And the reason there's no evidence about what Charter believed is that it was never the government's theory below that these numbers should be judged on the basis of the subjective understanding of a single cable operator. When Professor Shapiro described what question he was asking. This is at JA 737. He said, it's exactly the question they were asking. What would happen to subscribership if there was a long-term blackout of Turner? What would happen? What is the right prediction? What is a reasonable prediction? Not what did one distributor believe? Because, in fact, when distributors believed lower numbers, the 2% and the 2.5% I referred to from the blackouts of Viacom, Professor Shapiro said, I don't agree with those numbers. I think the right number is more like 9 to 14%. So this is really an estimate, a range that has no colorable foundation in this record. And if this one correction is made, then the entire result flips. And so, you know, the government and you know, Judge Santel, you talked about the relationship between the Nash theory and the model. This is all about not whether Nash is right or wrong, but a litigation model has to be subjected to the testing and probing of the adversarial process, and this one just absolutely fell apart. And the government should not be asking this court to
ensure. But the government's position is that we actually didn't need to put this model on. We could have established this with kind of what they call the first half of the expert testimony of Shapiro, which is simply that his expert view that applying the Nash principles and the Copperweld principles to this merger, there will be there's a reasonable probability that's going to affect competition such that the merger should be blocked. And they didn't need numbers, just like you didn't need numbers in Brown Shoe, et cetera. What's your response to that?
Well, they said that after the numbers all fell apart. And with all respect, Your Honor.
Well, sometimes, lawyers over-try their cases, and they go for the belt and suspenders, and then the suspenders break. And then they say, Judge, don't worry about my broken suspenders. I still got the belt.
This was not a case in which the government over-tried its case, Your Honor. If you take the model out, there is really nothing here that demonstrates anything other than a concern and a theory that there might be this leverage. There has to be a demonstration of two things. One, a substantial lessening of competition. And two, once the government has conceded significant consumer benefits, which it has, $78 million annually in price decreases is significant consumer benefits, then it itself agreed it has to balance the harm against the benefits. So the reason that the government tried to quantify this was not that it was over-trying its case and it was adding things in and it was extra icing on a cake already frosted on its side. The reason it was doing this is it had to. It said there were going to be benefits from this merger, and it acknowledged, in fact, if
the Open Markets Institute amicus brief says that's wrong. What should we do with that?
With respect, Your Honor, that wasn't even the government's position below. What the government's counsel said at the trial was, we agree 100% at the end of the day that we're the plaintiff. We have got to be persuasive on the balance of these two. Meaning, and I should just be clear, this is not a question of an efficiencies defense. We put on an efficiencies defense, and the judge didn't rely on any of it. Nothing in the judge's opinion relied on anything we put in our defense on efficiencies. It was the government's affirmative case that said, we are going to show, that was their claim, an average retail price increase. And if you're going to show an average retail price increase, you have to put on evidence of what's going to go up and what's going to go down. You can't just say, well, it's going to go down a little, it's going to go up a little, it's going to go down a huge amount, but we only have to show that it's going to go up a little in one segment. You are making a claim about an average. So that's why Professor Shapiro, he wasn't doing this out of the goodness of his heart. He said, this is a vertical merger. The methodology I'm bringing is to identify the benefits, identify the harms, and I'm going to show to you, he said, that the harms outweigh the benefits. That's where the model came in. That's where the quantification came in. If you subtract that from what happened below, you have no case for substantial lessened competition, no case that the balance of harms tilts against this transaction. And look, the only other thing I would say is this, that, the government and its amici have suggested that this case, is about the future of vertical merger law enforcement or some big principle of law. It's not about any of those things. It was about very specific evidence. And if the district court here is affirmed, as we obviously think it should be, that's not going to prevent the government from bringing factually supported merger cases in the future.
The district court's opinion, and I might have missed it, but I looked very closely for it. It didn't cite Copperweld once. Mm-hmm. Not once.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then there's really not much of any acknowledgement of kind of the unity of organization profit maximization by the single firm. And indeed, the district court makes a finding based on what reasonable minds could call self-serving testimony that Time Warner is going to really continue negotiating these deals the same after the merger as before. The district court seems to disclaim the key holding of Copperweld. And if we, you say that this case doesn't really have any big implications, well, the amici say otherwise, and don't they have a fair point that if we just simply affirm here without really grappling with that, we're saying that Copperweld isn't really the legal presumption that the Supreme Court said that it is? And isn't that above our pay grade?
I disagree both, Your Honor, with that characterization of the opinion and with what the consequences of affirmance would be. And let me deal with both of those separately, which is, first of all, you're right that the opinion never cites Copperweld because there was no disagreement, not on our side, not with the government, not with the district court, about the principle that firms will profit maximize across divisions. And the court didn't need to cite Copperweld because it was accepting that proposition, and it does so at pages 114 to 115, JA 161 to 162, where it accepts the proposition. It says the court accepts, and the proposition is a firm with multiple divisions will act to maximize profits across them. So that legal principle was not the subject of disagreement, not between the parties, not from the district court. What was the subject of disagreement was not whether firms profit maximize, but how, in this case, they would profit maximize. And that's what all the evidence goes to. And what the district court was reciting here, what he said was, I'll be very specific, he said, as the witnesses indicated, this is page 115, vertically integrated corporations have previously determined that the best way, and now I'm paraphrasing, to maximize profits is not to pursue the government's theory that there's some untapped leverage out there that suddenly can produce higher prices for the same content the day after the merger than you had before. What he was reporting was the witness testimony that people in the past who have been in vertically integrated companies have not believed that. They don't accept that that's the way to profit maximize. They want to profit maximize, but they pursue a different path, which is just to get their programming on as many different distribution platforms as they can. And this was the uniform testimony of every witness, not just our witnesses, but the government witnesses, every witness who had worked at a vertically integrated company. Every one of them said, we don't believe this theory. We didn't act about this theory. No one from high up told me, do something different in the programming negotiations than what you used to do, because you need to start taking into account this other division across the country. That instruction never came. People just kept on negotiating the same way they always did because they don't believe the pot of gold that the government says is there is really there. So in terms of the consequences of affirmance, you know, if the court agrees with what I just said, even if Your Honor doesn't agree with that characterization of the opinion, the court could write that in the opinion, and there'd be no issue about precedent or anything else, because this is what we think the opinion said. It certainly is our position, and we think it's the right one. And I think, you know, with that understood, the only thing an affirmance in this case would really stand for as a legal proposition is that models, litigation models that seek to implement economic theories have to be shown to be valid and not merely assumed, and that when you do modeling, you have to use reliable inputs and demonstrate that your predictions are statistically significant before those predictions will be credited. That's all the case stands for.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, counsel for Amici Curiae 37 Economist et al. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Andrew Pincus, representing the 37 economists and antitrust scholars, appearing here as amici supporting affirmance. I think the court's questions have really focused in on the critical issue that we presented in our brief and the critical issue before the court, which is that an economic theory by itself can't predict likely outcomes in a particular industry contest. And so the critical task for the economist is to make the right factual assumptions that reflect those real-world characteristics in order to reliably predict the likely future behavior. We think the district court understood the economic theory, understood the critical importance of those factual predicates, and as the court has been discussing, held for multiple independent reasons that the facts just weren't here to support the economist's projections. And I think it's important that the district court actually eschewed both parties' advanced broad legal theories. The court didn't rule on a broad legal theory. It didn't make broad statements about economic theory. It really ruled narrowly based on the facts. And I think it's helpful to look at the Nash theory as an example of how that worked. The court didn't, of course, hold Nash inapplicable, but the Nash theory is at quite a high level of generalization. The insight really is that in a negotiation, fallbacks matter, and the fallbacks will influence the bargain. Nash propagated that theory in a very simple context, a one-off bilateral negotiation in which he made clear there were no prior commitments between the parties. So it's a challenge to apply that here.
He expressly wrote that if there was prior bargaining agreement between the parties, it would render his theory inapplicable or at least.
Exactly, Your Honor. And economists have begun to look at the multilateral repeat player context to see how to apply it. And there is no consensus now in the economic literature about how to do that, as we explain in our brief, because it's a complicated problem. That's the factual context, though, that appears in this industry. And the other context that appears in this industry is that there are relevant prior commitments. There are MFN clauses. There are the arbitration commitment. And there are the FCC's program access rules, all of which are relevant and would have to be considered in some way, none of which, I should say, were considered by the government. So the challenge here is to take that very general theory and figure out how to apply it, what assumptions to make, and how to put those assumptions into the cake in order to come up with credible predictions. And the district court held that the government failed to do that, both with respect to Professor Shapiro's general assessment and with respect to the model. A lot of the conversation here has been about the model, but just to talk a little bit about the general assessment, what the district court said is, I'm going to look at the real-world evidence of what's happened when there have been integrations like this. And for three reasons, I conclude that this kind of integrated entity doesn't have bargaining leverage that is going to lead to a price increase. And he relied on three things. On the econometric analysis by Professor Carlton, that the prior instances of vertical integration did not lead to higher programming prices, and the district court rejected the government's arguments as a matter of fact for distinguishing those transactions. It looked to consistent testimony by current and former negotiators that integration was irrelevant to the fair strategy. And of course, as the discussion has indicated, the court cited the arbitration no blackout commitment, which eliminates the blackout threat. So putting aside the model, just looking at the real-world evidence, the court said, my factual finding is based on this evidence that the theory that Professor Shapiro was propagating based on Nash just isn't supported. And then the court turned to the model. And in addition to the output of problems that Mr. Keisler referred to, there are design problems because the model's design doesn't incorporate any of the differences from the Nash simplified world that I mentioned. It doesn't address the fact that this is multilateral repeat player negotiation. It doesn't address these prior commitments. And most importantly, it gets the credible fallback wrong. The model is based on a credible fallback assumption of permanent blackouts. And what the district court found as a fact is that permanent blackouts were not a credible threat. Temporary blackouts might be the credible threat. So with those flaws in the design of the model, it's not a surprise, in addition to the output problems that Mr. Keisler talked about, that there was no credible result. The outputs of the model couldn't credibly predict what was going to happen.
Let me just ask you, this is beyond the case, I understand, but the government files a complaint, and it has an expert based on what the state of the world is at that point. And then as things move forward, the merger agreement is modified by what you're being told is this permanent 7-year commitment on arbitration. From your experience, is the option then simply to ask for a continuance and have another expert model developed? Now, there are all kinds of timing considerations here, I understand. But I'm just wondering, I mean, the whole nature of the case changes once this arbitration condition is added. And, you know, the government's expert was flat-footed on that. I mean, acknowledged that you need a new model.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's flat-footed, and I'm not the expert on the facts, but I think just in terms of the real-world timing in this case, this happened very early on in the case. In fact, the government had a second expert, which I think Mr. Keisler mentioned, who was prepared to testify on the impact of the arbitration no-blackout commitment. So this happened early enough that not only could Professor Shapiro have revised his model, but it was early enough so that the government could have an expert ready to testify. They didn't call that expert.
All right, so it's not a question in ITA.
I don't think it's a question. I don't think it's an issue in this case.
The government anticipated, but perhaps for whatever reason decided not to call that expert. All right.
So I don't think there's any problem of them being
sandbagged. All right, the timing thing is not. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to just make three quick points in rebuttal. The first is that the AT&T, my colleagues on the other side, are asking this court to make findings that are not there. And the best evidence of that is the discussion of the arbitration offer. There's no finding about what the real-world impact of arbitration will be. All that we have on that is the testimony from the distributors. We have the testimony from Cox's witness, one of the cable companies, that said, this does not have any weight. We have a testimony from the Dish's executive that says that this is too risky.
What if we write that they are judicially estopped from not honoring?
Your Honor, I don't think that's the only problem with the arbitration offer. The primary problem, what these witnesses were actually testifying about, was that they didn't know how it would work because it imposes on the arbitrator a standard of fair market value. And when we have a nationwide distributor like DirecTV, unlike a regional distributor like Comcast, as in the NBCU-Comcast merger.
But isn't there a nationwide distributor in Dish?
Yes, Your Honor, but the way that the arbitrator has to calculate fair market value is based on what the price of Turner's content should be. And so here, when we have the nationwide distributor of DirecTV affecting the price of the Turner content, that makes it different from the Comcast-NBCU merger. There's also a second reason, Your Honor, which is that in the Comcast-NBCU merger, the arbitral remedy was backed by the de novo arbitral review by the FCC, and as opposed to here, where it's a private offer between two parties. So they had the FCC as a backstop, and that's another reason that both Professor Shapiro, actually, and Cox testified that it was risky for them, and they gave it no weight. And so I think that's what we have on the arbitration issue, and that is consistent with the court's treatment of it, and the Supreme Court's recognition that this type of remedy issue, where the parties propose some sort of remedy to a merger that is sort of admittedly creating problems, as the court said in General Dynamics, is not the right way to view it. And I see that I'm expired out of my time, but I would...
Oh, please go on.
Oh, well, thank you, Your Honor. The second thing that I wanted to say in rebuttal was they're asking you to create a revised opinion in another respect as well. They're asking you to make Professor Shapiro's analysis and the rejection thereof by the district court an independent ground for affirmance. I think, though, that I heard my colleague on the other side respond to Judge Rogers' question by saying... when she asked him, is it an independent ground for affirmance, in slightly different words, I think he said no. And so I think that that's an important concession that the audio tape will record. The other thing that I wanted to mention, Your Honor, is in response to Judge Wilkins' question about the $350 million and whether that's independent ground for reversal, I wanted to make sure I was clear. If this court's rationale is based on Professor Shapiro's analysis and the district court's treatment of it, then the $350 million is independently problematic because of this court's decision in Anthem. And the last point I'd like to make, Your Honor, on the corporate maximization issue, the profit maximization issue that Judge Sentell and I, and I think perhaps others, were discussing, what we have to believe here for the district court's anti-Copperwell reasoning to hold is that the new company will maximize distribution of content over using its leverage to increase profits. That's contrary to Copperwell. It was the dissent in Copperwell that said that there should be a fact-specific inquiry as to whether the companies are integrated. That's on 796 of the Copperwell dissent. The Supreme Court majority took no notice of that. It said, no, the corporation behaves as a unity of interest. And that's what's incorrect about the district court's decision. If I may, I'll say one additional thing about, actually two additional things, one about Professor Carlton and one about the Altman-Volandri study. With respect to Professor Carlton, this is another example of the other side attempting to cut and paste the opinion to create a better opinion. Professor Carlton's analysis, it is true the district court looked at that, his analysis of prior vertical mergers, although I think he only actually gave probative weight to the Comcast-NBCU one, if you read the opinion closely. But that's not some sort of independent ground for affirmance. That's one part. I think it's 35 pages into the district court's analysis. So that can't by itself be sufficient, cutting and pasting the opinion and putting it back together to make a new opinion. And then with respect to Altman-Volandri, and this is my last point, I think the key there is that the government repeatedly argued in the district court, the first statement in its statement of the facts about the Altman-Volandri study was that it mattered because it was what Charter thought. Professor Shapiro testified on JA 709, the reason he's looking at the Altman-Volandri study is because it's what Charter thinks. That's JA 709. And so this was the position all along. And that does mean that the Altman-Volandri study has to be looked at a different light. Now, they've thrown up a lot of smoke about an edit being made in a waiting room for an airplane. Of course, what that all gets to is that Altman-Volandri independently decided that it needed to update its methodology. That's what our brief details. It needed to fix its methodology. It's true that an executive at Altman-Volandri sent one email from a waiting room, as I'm sure we all do. But what also happened is that Altman-Volandri then subsequently, later, perhaps after the plane landed, updated the rest of its methodology and the rest of its data on a going-forward basis. So I don't think that they can get quite the weight out of that they would like. And in any event, Your Honor, the Altman-Volandri number is supported by a sealed drop analysis from Comcast, so I won't mention the number, but it is supported by that, and Professor Shapiro also mentioned that. In conclusion, this is a merger that will shape the industry for decades to come. Though the other side likes to say that it's a 0.2% price increase that adds up for hundreds of millions of dollars over time, the district court's decision on such a merger should be free of inconsistencies, and we would ask this court to reverse and remand for further consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the case under advisement.
Stand, please. This honorable court now stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m.